From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, April 12th, 2018. And on this day, arguments in the Maine Supreme Judicial Court today on ranked choice voting. And we'll look at how an Oxford County school is trying to address student poverty. That's ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Norway Savings, supporting the colorful vision of Maine's business owners. Live your life in color. NorwaySavings.bank.
The state Supreme Judicial Court heard oral arguments today in a rare case that could determine whether Maine's ranked choice voting system will be used in the June primary. The expedited hearing was in response to a request by Maine Senate Republicans that the court halt state implementation of the new system. But during a 35-minute hearing, nearly all seven justices appeared skeptical of the Republicans' arguments, and some wondered why the court was asked to solve a problem that the legislature wouldn't or couldn't. Steve Missler has more.
The Senate Republicans' attorney, Tim Woodcock, made it through about a minute of his arguments before Chief Justice Lee Sofley had a question.
So let me press you on that very issue, Mr. Sir. Woodcock.
It was the first of many questions for Woodcock. He was pressed repeatedly by the justices as he attempted to argue a central point, that state election officials were taking steps to set up a ranked choice voting system without authorization from the legislature. Woodcock attempted to argue that doing so is a breach of the separation of powers, because lawmakers had never specifically allocated money to the Secretary of State for that purpose. But Justice Donald Alexander was skeptical.
The funds are appropriated to supervise elections, which is the Secretary of State's statutory and constitutional authority.
Woodcock said this election is different. He cited problems with election officials' plans to collect ballots when a ranked choice contest moves into its runoff tabulation phase. But Justice Andrew Mead wondered why the court was being asked to intervene at all.
Couldn't reasonable minds have gotten together and said, well, this is an obstacle, this is the solution. Why are we here today?
You're describing the legislative process.
That's a sad commentary, isn't it?
Justice Ellen Gorman made a similar point and wondered why the entire legislature wasn't as concerned as the Senate Republicans.
Mr. Woodcock, the legislature is still in session, is it not?
I understand.
And so the legislature, if it were truly worried about this, could take some action between now and the day of its closing bell, rather than bringing an action in the third branch of government to bring things to a standstill, correct?
There is no consensus in the legislature.
Woodcock then posed an ominous warning if the Secretary of State is allowed to move forward. Again, he was challenged by Gorman.
What is going to happen on Election Day is that private couriers...
Is that there will be an actual controversy for which we could issue a determination.
And it will be an election catastrophe.
The judges had fewer questions for Phyllis Gardner, an assistant attorney general representing the Secretary of State. She was asked to refute Woodcock's argument that the legislature didn't allocate money specifically for ranked choice.
This is not a new program. This is elections. As Justice Alexander noted earlier, the Secretary of State administers elections. We're simply administering them by a slightly different method this time.
Attorney James Monteleone, representing ranked choice voting advocates, said the Secretary of State has full authority to conduct a ranked choice election.
It has never been the practice for the legislature to essentially micromanage the minutiae of which elections are funded and which ones aren't.
The court recessed without making a decision, but it will likely deliver one soon, as there are only 90 days left before the June 12th primary. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
As part of a deal to win a state permit for a major transmission project 8 years ago, Central Maine Power agreed to transfer the scenic Kennebec River Gorge to the state. But that never happened, and now environmentalists say that raises troubling questions about a new CMP project that would cross the same gorge. Fred Bever reports.
In 2010, the Department of Environmental Protection approved a site permit for CMP's plan for a massive transmission upgrade and expansion. And CMP agreed to protect thousands of acres of land elsewhere to compensate for ecosystems and recreational resources that would be disturbed by the project. David Littell, the DEP commissioner under then-Governor John Baldacci, negotiated the deal.
The idea was that they'll be protected, and they'll be protected through either a conveyance or an easement to a third party.
CMP offered to donate to the state the scenic Kennebec River Gorge and 1,400 acres around it, stretching from the Harrison Dam to the Forks. Regulators said that was above and beyond the minimum required, and they took the gift. But 8 years later, CMP still owns the parcel. That's caught Littell by surprise.
It's essentially not protected. To have no enforcement authority or no one actually ensuring that it's protected means it isn't.
CMP in 2011 did establish covenants that ostensibly protect the property, but that document also says title to the parcel will be conveyed to the state's Department of Environmental Conservation. And with that still undone, Littell says the gorge remains at risk.
Until you have a third party in place, and in this case it was supposed to be the Department of Conservation, then the job isn't done. The wildlife habitat's not protected. The ability of the public to use the parcel is not guaranteed. Essentially, CMP can do anything they want with the parcel.
So the commitment's in place. It's always been in place. The covenants are in place. The land is protected. What has not happened is a simple sort of the legal transfer from CMP to the state.
John Carroll is a CMP spokesman. He says CMP has managed the property in accord with the covenants, protecting it from development and allowing public access. As evidence of good faith, Carroll notes that every year the company has formally notified the state of its intent to complete transfer of the title.
And each year it gets kicked down the road. Neither party wants to put the time into going through the last steps, the final legal steps. And it's just, we need to get it off our books. We've been paying taxes on it the whole time as well.
An official in the Department of Environmental Protection says the agency can enforce the covenants, but former DEP Commissioner Littell disagrees, and one environmental group that supported CMP's original mitigation deal says uncertainty around the gorge's status is troubling. Dylan Voorhees is Clean Energy Director for the Natural Resources Council of Maine.
Without the actual title to the property being conveyed to the state, as was described in the covenant, it's a little bit like Central Maine Power was making a deal with itself. So I think it's problematic, and I think it needs to be resolved.
And there's another issue, Voorhees says. One document related to the original deal reveals that CMP retained rights to a 300-foot corridor that crosses the Kennebec River at the gorge. That happens to be the pathway that CMP has chosen to build a new transmission line to bring electricity from Canada to Massachusetts. Former DEP Commissioner Littell says the corridor carve-out was a fair bargain, given the business CMP is in, but Voorhees says it's a glaring loophole.
I think that's a warning to anybody who is interacting with Central Maine Power. They were trying to buy goodwill. And we have to ask what the value of that is. And if the primary threat to this parcel of land from a development perspective is actually transmission lines, what did we get for that?
As part of its efforts to win a new permit for the new transmission project, CMP is negotiating a mitigation package with a group of stakeholders in the Kennebec River Gorge area. The group includes commercial rafters, economic development officials, and Larry Warren, founder of the Maine Hudson Trail System. In an email, Warren says he's been assured that the state will finally take title to the original parcel before a new permit is issued. A spokesman for the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry says the title transfer is, quote, still under consideration. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And you can find links to documents related to the fate of the Kennebec River Gorge on our website. Three of Maine's most prestigious private colleges are among several elite U.S. educational institutions caught up in a Department of Justice antitrust investigation. A.J. Higgins has details.
First reported by Inside Higher Ed and the Wall Street Journal, the federal antitrust investigation involves allegations of information exchanges among the schools regarding early decision students seeking admission to multiple colleges. The Department of Justice has declined to comment on the probe, but the Wall Street Journal reported that it appears the feds are trying to determine whether the schools accepted or rejected students seeking admission based on the admission decisions of other colleges the students applied to. The communications offices for Bates, Bowdoin, and Colby Colleges confirmed that they have in fact received notifications from the Department of Justice about the ongoing probe and are complying with their requests. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
Mainers can expect to see petitions circulating in the coming weeks asking if they'd like to see a physician-assisted suicide initiative on the fall ballot next year. Jennifer Mitchell has that story.
Valerie Lovelace from Wiscasset-based Maine Death with Dignity is one of those spearheading the petition drive to be launched next week. She volunteers for hospice.
I sit at the bedside of individuals who have died, and that has not gone well.
Lovelace says two cases in particular were excruciating, and both of those people wanted to choose when to end their lives, but couldn't.
And so I promised them I would continue until we had this option in Maine.
Under the proposal, a person would need to receive a terminal diagnosis from at least two doctors before being eligible to receive the medication to end their lives. Lovelace says it's about providing a dignified choice for people who are still capable of making what she describes as a highly important and very personal decision. But critics, like hospice Dr. Jim Van Kirk, says he's concerned that patients, especially in rural areas of the state, aren't given anything better right now. And that, he says, is the real problem.
Gee, I'm sorry you have a terminal process, but we don't have palliative care where you are, and we don't have hospice where you are. But you have a choice to take these pills and end your life. That's really not giving people a choice. That's saying we're not going to make a societal effort to provide you appropriate care.
Two recent attempts to create a Death with Dignity bill in the legislature have failed, although attempts stretch back to the 1990s, shortly after passage of such a bill in Oregon. Since then, four more states have passed assisted suicide bills, with legislation under review in a handful of other states. A public policy poll taken in 2017 showed 73% of Mainers supportive of a patient's right to choose a planned death. The Maine Medical Association has recently changed its position from opposed to neutral. Maine Death with Dignity must collect more than 61,000 valid signatures to place an initiative on the November 2019 ballot. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
And finally today, while the economy around the country has improved in recent years, that's not the case for some rural parts of Maine, like Oxford County. More than a quarter of the children in that county live in poverty, and many families struggle with basic needs like food, housing, and transportation. Ruby Feinberg brings us the story of how a rural school is stepping in to help some of those families by going from the classroom to the living room.
For close to a year, Brittany Manzo struggled to find an affordable apartment in Norway, Maine. She's got five kids, so it wasn't easy. Manzo poured through listings, filled out applications, but she says there were few affordable rentals. And so the family found itself living in a small hotel room for months at a time.
The whole time I just tried to keep things as normal as possible. It was tough. I don't wish it upon anybody.
Manzo says much of her income went to paying for the room, making it nearly impossible to afford the upfront costs and security deposit of a long-term rental. She also watched how living in a hotel room affected her kids. Dinner would take hours cooked on tiny appliances. And crying babies in small quarters led to arguments and sleepless nights.
None of us were getting along. It was horrible. You know, we just needed to be in a house or an apartment, something bigger than one room.
While the situation was hard, it's not unusual for many families in Oxford County or in Maine. Despite a local unemployment rate below 4%, many families here still struggle to make ends meet.
We were seeing it impacting our schools.
And Oxford Hills School District Superintendent Rick Colpitz says those kinds of issues outside of school make a big difference in the classroom.
Kids were coming in on Monday without really having a lot to eat over the weekend, which meant that it was a hard day. You had kids that were coming in that were not adequately clothed, and it was because they didn't have a resource or know where the resource was to access clothing. And so we saw families having to make choices.
Oxford Hills has tried to ease these burdens by creating school food banks and partnering with social service agencies. In the past, that work often ended at the school's walls. But this year, the district is trying a new approach to help families get the services they need outside of the classroom. Early on a recent weekday morning, Whitney Marston leaves the school's grounds and pulls into a small driveway a few streets away. She's here to talk with Brittany Manzo, the mother of five who was forced to live in a hotel room. The two embrace, then Manzo opens the door for Marston to come inside.
You are fine.
Marston is what's known at the school as a family service advocate. Typically, she'll spend a few hours with kids, then meet with parents, like Brittany Manzo. And she does it here, at their home. Her goal is to find out what they need. It could be heating, housing, transportation, or something else. Combine these issues can be overwhelming.
There's just tons of different barriers, every obstacle you could think of. So really trying to sit down with them and figure out what we can do to make this easier for you.
It was while she was living in the hotel room that Manzo says she found a letter in her daughter's backpack with a note from Marston introducing herself. At first, Manzo was unsure about letting a stranger help her.
It's because you're like, oh no, okay, so not only do I have to admit that I'm in a hotel, but that I have 5 children, and I've been in there a year. So, yeah, I didn't want people to, you know, think down on me, or that was what was hard about it.
But she did make the call. She and Marston met and talked and filled out housing applications. And after a few months, she found an affordable house on her own, only a few blocks from her daughter's school.
And this is the bathroom. This floor, actually.
Manzo takes me on a short tour of her new home, showing off the new appliances, the tiles she's redone in the bathroom, and all the furniture that Marston had arranged to be delivered on the first day she moved in.
3 bed sets for the kids, coffee pot, microwave, just dishes. I mean, everything, really, to get you where you would need to get started. I mean, it really, yeah. It was awesome.
This kind of home visit program isn't new. It's been used by Head Start preschool programs for decades. And in recent years, cities like New York and Washington, D.C. have launched their own models after seeing the improvements on student attendance and achievement. Despite those results, there is still resistance to programs like these. Carol Guestwicky, who authored a book on family-school relations, says some families may perceive them as judgmental. Earlier this year, some lawmakers in Utah even opposed a teacher home visit program because of worries over government intrusion.
What are they going to do, come poke their nose in our business? And I don't want somebody seeing what old living room furniture I have and, you know, all those kinds of things.
That's why Guestwicky recommends training staff and keeping visits informal.
A lot of parents have had other kinds of professionals come into their home, and usually it's not good news.
At Oxford Hills, the home visit program is one of the first in the state that's gone beyond preschool and into elementary school. But it's still small. Only 2 staff members work with families across 2 elementary schools. And the future of the program is also uncertain. It's funded by a grant that will expire next year. But district officials say they're looking for ways to keep it going, given the difference it can make for some families. Brittany Manzo says her children are already happier.
So much of a bigger change in them. I mean, that brings me in tears because it's so, it was hard.
As she stands in her own living room, looking at her children's artwork on the walls, Manzo says she finally feels happy too. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And you're listening to Maine Public Radio. This story is part of the Rural Maine Reporting Project, our new initiative to cover underreported issues from around the state. You can find more information at mainepublic.org/ruralreporting. For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Thursday, April 12th, 2018. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.